Welcome to Season 2 of The Wayfarer's Guide to World Building, a podcast for writers by Mythos & Inc. Publishing. I'm Kyle.
I'm Emma.
I'm Allison.
And I'm Christiana.
Today's trope, evil has been locked away for centuries. Special thanks to our patrons for making this episode possible. If you are a patron, send us your writing, world building, and publishing questions for us to answer in our bonus Q&A episodes, which we record as a thank you for our Patreon supporters. Eons ago, people faced a terrible evil and were unable to defeat it, but they locked it away so it would never bother the earth again. Or did we say never? We meant, of course, that the bars of the prison will weaken in 1,000 years and will be set free to ravage the world once more. But that's future humanity's problem. This trope lends a certain panache to your villain. They are legendary. They are powerful. They are feared and probably immortal. Who wants to go up against that? I'm Kyle, he, him, business director and host for today.
I'm Allison, she, her, editorial director at Mythos & Inc.
And I'm Christiana, they, them, public relations director at Mythos & Inc.
All right, so evil has been locked away for centuries, and there is none more evil than Allison. So you can go
first. How dare you? So I know we said this evil was future humanity's problem, but in my version, it's the future dragon's problem, because I'm talking about the series Wings of Fire by Tuli T. Sutherland, which Ooh. Kyle has had his ear talked off about this series because his daughter.
Not from you. Yeah, from
my daughter. And who is also my goddaughter, which is why I'm reading this series, because I wanted to read it with her. Just loves it so much. And you know, for good reason. It's really well written. It's a middle grade series. I'm 12 books in and still enjoying it, so yay. So there is one character in the second arc of this story who has been lying asleep in enchanted sleep under a mountain for 2,000 years, and it's this dragon called Darkstalker who has all these mythical powers. The dragons mostly don't exist anymore. Dragons don't really have, I mean, they do, because it's, you know, you gotta have magic come into play, but most dragons don't have these powers. So he can read minds, he can foresee the future, and he can cast spells. So like, I understand why when he got a little crazy and started doing evil stuff, the other dragons were like, we can't deal with this. We're going to just put him under this mountain and him to sleep forever. And now that problem's dealt with. But of course, the magic spell that had put him to sleep breaks, and he wakes up and wreaks havoc upon the dragon land of Pyria. So what I really like about this story is it's not really doing anything new with the trope. And I feel like a lot of the tropes I use, this is the case. I just like it when people use tropes, but they just do them really well. And so how Tui does this well, Tui Sutherland, the author, she just makes it personal. So one of the main characters has mind reading powers after no dragon has had this for years, but this little girl dragon can read minds, and so Darkstalker can talk to her. So she kind of becomes friends with him and doesn't really realize that he's evil, and that's what raises the stakes and makes you really engaged in this character. And you're also not sure at first whether, because he says that he's changed when he comes out, and you're not sure at first if he's telling the truth or not. And it's done really well, because the girl dragon can actually, can she read his mind? No, I think he can block her. Anyway, but she gets to know him really well, and yeah, tensions are high. It's just really well done. That's why that's my example.
I have first a comment and then a question.
Okay.
The comment is, Darkstalker is the coolest name I could ever possibly imagine for a dragon that could read minds.
Right?
That is legitimately so cool. It makes me want to read it. My question is, if Darkstalker can force you the future, does it always come true? Is it fated, like with the fates in Oedipus, or like Monkey's Paw, or you know what I mean? Like, is it always going to come true the way that Darkstalker sees it? Or is it at the moment, given the decision of the characters at that moment in time?
I actually really like how they handled this, because I feel like prophetic abilities always come into this problem that why don't they, you know? But for Darkstalker, he sees a bunch of possible futures, and he can see what's more likely to happen and what's less likely to happen. And then he can kind of like nudge things the way he wants to, but it's not for sure. It depends on what other people do. So I really like that there's still that aspect of free will in there, like, oh, it, you know, this future might happen unless this dragon does something else, and then this future will happen.
Yeah. Right?
So I thought that was
That. I think that opens up a lot more possibilities for story. Like if you're an author and you're trying to come up with prophecies, the idea of blank will happen if XYZ is a lot more interesting to me than blank will happen. You can't escape it.
Yeah, right? And the author plays with prophecy quite a bit, actually, in this entire series. Like the first arc is based on this prophecy of these five special dragons coming to change the future, and then you find out who made that prophecy and what it's really about. I don't want to spoil anything, but I really like how she dealt with that.
So my question then, because I don't fully know all of this, did they know that the spell was going to break, or did it just suddenly break, or how did that pan out?
So there was an earthquake at the end of the first five arc story. And then at the beginning of this next arc, you find out that the earthquake broke the enchanted bracelet that was around his arm. And that was what had put him to sleep. And then that sort of kickstarted.
Gotcha. Extreme weather is the downfall of us all. Got it.
Yeah.
Got it.
Right. That's
incidentally, we do family question at dinner. My daughter has picked this up, and she asked, if you had three wishes, what would you wish for? And her number one wish was for dragons to be real.
That's a great wish.
Like, careful what you wish for, child. And two, for her to have, like, I can't even remember all the little details of the dragon. It was just like this particular dragon living in the forest. It's like, oh my goodness. So yes, of course. But it doesn't sound, I mean, it still sounds light as we talk about it. Like, that's not even, I'm willing to wager that Christiana can up the evil quotient in this.
Yes, I will. I am always here to up the evil quotient. That's what I exist for.
Hang on while I sacrifice a live animal to my altar before we start.
So I have a goat here. Anyway, my example is Evil Dead. It's right in the title. It's right there. For those who don't know Evil Dead, it's originally a movie series directed by Sam Raimi, known better for Spider-Man than Evil Dead. It follows a group of university students who vacation at an isolated cabin. And of course, strange things start happening. And eventually, in trying to investigate why these strange things are happening, they find their way down to the cellar, in which they open it and they find a bunch of weird things in there. And in it, they find the Book of the Dead, and along with it, a tape recorder. So they take it upstairs and they're looking at the book and they play the tape recorder. And of course, the tape recorder has all these ancient Sumerian incantations on it that resurrect a demonic entity. And of course, the demon is summoned and very many horror movie things follow. If you haven't seen the movies, I would gently direct you to check out the content warnings before you watch them. The first two have some pretty sensitive content in it. But why I decided this as an example, because it's pretty basic, right? Group of teens go to cabin in the woods, use incantations from an ancient book, summon demons. What I think is really interesting about it and makes it a good world building example is that though the first movie, the original, The Evil Dead, is quite grim and scary, it's better known by its sequel. And its sequel is much more campy and funny. And I would say more people even know the current TV series going on, Ash versus the Evil Dead, where it's super campy and super silly. And there's lots of chainsaw arms and crazy things that happen. And why I think it's a really good example of storytelling is because it's been used across the whole franchise. It's a very basic concept. People summon Sumerian demons and Kandarian demons. They create deadites. They have to fight them, this kind of thing. But it goes from the original Evil Dead being kind of dark. And then there's also a more recent remake that is, in my controversial opinion, better than the first one.
Ooh.
And way darker, way grimmer, and way scarier. But then there's also the series that's like super campy and super funny. And I think this is a really good example because you can take the same idea and create very different stories depending on how you use it.
That was actually going to be my question, which you kind of answered, is how do you stretch the same idea over and over again in a series? Like, is it a different story every time? Or are they the same characters?
So often it's the same characters, but they take a jump from, I would describe the difference between the first Evil Dead movie and the second Evil Dead movie as like, Bruce Campbell is very scared for good reason and fighting for his life. And then in the second movie, Bruce Campbell is frustrated with the situation and puts a chainsaw on his arm to deal with it. Like, it's very, they take the same characters and the same situation, but depending on the writing and the situations that they find themselves in, I think that's the main thing. Whereas in the original Evil Dead, the problems that they face, the situations that they come across are pretty dire and pretty grim. And like I said, look at the content warnings before you decide to watch this. But they take the same characters and then instead put them in kind of silly situations in the further along in the franchise as you go, they just put them in sillier and sillier situations. So it's the same demons, it's the same characters. It's just a very different situation and a very different result.
There's a book. It's an autobiography by Bruce Campbell, who's the lead in all this. He's actually in every Sam Raimi film. He gets bit roles. Even in Spider-Man, he's in there. He's the ticket taker in one of them at the theater, and he refused. But anyways, If Chins Could Kill, Confessions of a B-Movie Actor is a wonderful autobiography, and it talks about him and Sam and all their friends growing up making movies and how they did some of those things and the ways in which of like, how do you do, like, they needed to build like a sliding mount for a camera, and they literally just mounted a camera onto onto a 2x4 and then greased up a longer 2x4 with Vaseline to slide it across to make sure it's nice and even.
Yes.
So it's just like fascinating things like this, but you really get that feeling of these movies of like, this is just a bunch of kids that have the most basic premise and they wanted to make something that was horror and funny at the same time.
Yes. And I think you could still see that. I think in every Sam Raimi movie I've ever watched, they have that one classic shot that was first formulated in the first Evil Dead, where it's kind of like a POV shot from the monster and is kind of like shaky and sped up a little bit. So it's kind of like, you know, you see the door of the cabin and these innocent college students in it. And then you see the camera kind of like rushing up to it and shaking a little bit before there's like a knock on the door or something. Right. And I feel like you still see that a lot in Sam Raimi's filmmaking. And it's my spouse and I call it the Evil Dead shot. Anytime we see it, we're like, oh, it's the Evil Dead shot. They did the thing.
So my question then just deals with because the Evil Dead series has a cult following. Like, it is,
yes,
dare I say, occult following. but how does a story like this really spot, like, what is it that drives such passion and love for such a series to create that?
I think it's the simplicity of the story. If I had to take a stab, the reason why I love it, like, I love this series so much. I used to have a pet tarantula and its name was Candarian after the demons. Like, I'm like fully sold on this series. And the thing that I loved about it so much is that it's so simple, but it's so interesting. And I think that's part of Sam Raimi's directing and how he takes stories and how he visually directs people through a story makes it so interesting. But it's something that it's just like so easy to get behind. You know, like a bunch of college kids in a cabin, freaky things happen. They summon a demon. You're like, okay, sold. I understand the story. What happens next? Right. And I think that's part of what
it doesn't need to be complicated.
I think that's part of what gets people behind it so much.
Well, that's a tough one to follow because I am a big fan of Bruce Campbell in particular. Highly loved him in Burn Notice too. But the thing that I'm bringing is probably one of like my favorite science fictions of all time, and this would be Battlestar Galactica. So the premise of Battlestar Galactica is you have humans that have advanced to such a stage that they built these robots that eventually just get tired of being laborers and abused and nobodies, and you know, that's where they kind of gain this autonomy that they're just tools. And they don't like that. So they leave and they're just gone. They all up and left on spaceships and they were gone. But then after a long, long time, they come back. And this is like evil being locked away. But this isn't the only time the series does it. But I'll get to that in a second. They come back. And the fascinating thing is they don't look like robots anymore. They look like humans. And they have this meeting of like the president of the entire colonies is meeting with a representative from the Cylons to talk about peace or broker some sort of relationship. And it's a trap. And in that moment, 95% of the entire human race is annihilated because they had plants and just bombs go off everywhere. And what was like like 30 billion people is reduced to about 30,000. And it's just this, now the humans are on the run. And that's where the Battlestar Galactica series kind of kicks off, is that they are just on the run, trying to survive, slowly losing more and more people, but the human race is being hunted by these Cylons. They don't know why, they don't know for what purpose, they don't know how they're tracking them, they don't know all of these things, and it's just running. But here's the evil has been locked away, is that they realize that they look just like us. Any one of us could be a Cylon. And there's these moments of, is that person a Cylon? And I remember when the show first aired, there was just so many questions of like, maybe this person, no, it can't be that person. Maybe it's this person, no, it can't be that person. Mm-hmm. And there's just such suspicion from the viewer because that tension was built inside like those characters and those moments. And it was just unbelievably mind-blowing in terms of trying to discover where the evil was locked away. And why I think it was a good story, because there were times where even the evil that was locked away didn't know it was evil until it was too late. Fascinating stories. I love Battlestar. They did everything right except end it. So
do they know why they're doing what they're doing? Do they have like a clear motive? Do they wake up and they're just like, man, I hate humans. I just want to get rid of them. And they have like a clear motivation
Yes. And so what we discover is that there are nine models that are the human-like models. So they're the ones that look human. And so we know that there's like nine of them, or was it 13? I can't remember the exact number offhand. I'm going to doubt myself.
There was a bunch of them.
I feel like it's
13 sounds right to me too.
It might be 13.
Because I know the number changed at one point, but that all that aside, and each one of them has different motivations.
Ooh,
and that's what. So you have the first, the one who just wants, he just wants them wiped off, like he's not okay. But then there's ones that are sympathetic, and they want, They actually want to breed and have hybrid, but they need to have control over them and, you know, that sort of thing, and create hybrid. Then there's ones that are just want to defend the humans. And there's ones that it's fascinating because it feels really, really weird. We don't know their motivation, but slowly more and more, many of them are just angry. Some of them are sympathetic. Some of them are sort of sympathetic. And you're learning more and more that each of those have personalities, and that's affecting everything too.
Interesting.
So this is more an observation than a question, but feel free to expand on it. Yeah,
okay, can do.
Sure. I feel like the reason that this trope of evil being locked away for centuries is used again and again, is it because it gives the villains this, it gives the characters awe of the villains and fear and like, we are afraid of this thing. It's been here before. And I think BSG does that really good because like they made the villains.
Right.
And so there's that added layer of like, we brought this upon ourselves. I hope they never come back. I hope that that's over with, that problem that we just ignored and hope will go away. And then they do come back and they are so much more advanced and angry, a lot of them, than humanity expected, that they just get wiped off the map.
Well, and I think that's part of that mystery, right? Right.
Yeah.
Like you kind of know, like even in the dragon story, you kind of know that this is a bad thing, but you don't really know.
You don't know for sure. Right. Maybe it'll be okay.
It's like a myth. It's maybe a story. It's not as bad. It's been embellished. But then when it actually happens, and it is, it's scary. And that's the point, I think. So, yeah, I think that's one of the things of like, there's that.
I agree with that. Because when you look at me being a giant horror buff, you look at how many horror movies are based off of urban legends, right?
Mm. Yeah.
Things like the Candyman. And things like Bloody Mary, things like The Grudge, things like The Ring, all of these really famous horror movies that invoke so much fear are based off of this fact of prior knowledge. Mm-hmm. We're like, I heard if you watch this videotape, you'll die in 7 days. Yeah. And I heard if you say Candyman however many times, then Candyman will appear, right? And like, I think it's like that prior knowledge, that notoriety, that makes things so much scarier when it comes to this kind of locked away hidden evil.
Mm, yes.
Well, we've got a couple of announcements before we get to the questions that you should ask yourself if you decide to play with this trope in your novel or world or wherever you're writing it. If you think this podcast is worth at least a dollar's worth of education and entertainment, consider supporting the show through Patreon at patreon.com/mythosandink. Using the magic of technology to pause time for just a moment here to ask a really important favor. If you're enjoying this podcast and want to hear more of it, the most helpful thing you can do is to write us a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to our podcast. Positive reviews are the number one way for a new podcast to get more listeners, which in turn will let us do all sorts of cool things like transcribe all our episodes and from recording bi-weekly to maybe even weekly. You can go leave us one right now. I promise I'll keep time paused until you get back. Evil is everywhere. It's just been locked away and we don't know about it yet, I think. What should you ask yourself if you have an ancient evil in the world that you are building?
You should ask yourself, how can you make it personal to some of the characters in your novel? Even though it's been centuries since we've seen this evil, is there some connection that you can give them to this evil anyway? Maybe it's just a myth they've heard, or maybe it's really their ancestor, or maybe like in Darkstalker, he can talk to one of the people in their head and that gives her a connection to him, or whatever the case may be. How can you make it personal and build attention that way?
My question would be, how can you use the evil? Like in the example of the Evil Dead, is it campy and fun and full of chainsaw arms? Or is it really grim and dark and something to be genuinely scared of? I think evil can be something that you can use in both horror and comedy in a vast array of genres. So if you have a locked away evil, how are you going to use it?
My question relies on the mystery of things. Long ago, there are stories of this, but because it's been so long, there's still some mystery to it. So how can you use that mystery to shock not only your reader, but even the characters themselves? If this is truly evil, how does that mystery get it wrong? And how does it get it right in a way that really captivates your reader? Well, the hosts of Wayfarer's Guide to Worldbuilding are also staff at Mythos & Ink Publishing, where we publish books for geeks by geeks. At the end of each podcast episode, we'll give you a little insight into the creative world that we're also living in and the creative works that we've been doing. Allison, what have you been up to?
Right now, I've been working on launching a new book series called Gender Swapped Classics. And the first book in the series, which is Victoria Frankenstein, will be out, I believe, next week on June 3.
Ooh.
And I'm really excited. It was really fun to swap the genders around in this classic novel. It kind of became like a matriarchal society as a result, which was really interesting to see. And Frankenstein is a girl and she goes on adventures and it's horrifying and most of her friends get killed, but you should read it because it's really good.
Where can we find this book, Allison? Hint, hint, nudge, nudge.
Everywhere books are sold, Barnes and Noble, Amazon, I'm drawing a blank at bookstores, Chapters.
Indigo Chapters.
Your local bookstore. If you're in the UK, Waterstones, most bookstores should have it online. You can order it online.
Awesome. Christiana, what have you been up to?
I've shared before on the podcast, I'm currently working full-time and going through grad school. So my creative endeavors have not been great, but I would like to share that I've paused my adult responsibilities because My Chemical Romance released a new song today. So my creative endeavor will be spending the next week in my daydreams, daydreaming about my teenage dreams and being front and center with My Chemical Romance. So that's my goals.
My word.
And also thinking about all the awesome stories that could go along with their songs, because fun fact, most of their albums are actually conceptual. So their first album is about vampires. And that's what I'm going to be thinking about.
Is that what first drew you to My Chemical Romance?
Yeah, that and like a general teenage angst.
Oh man, creative endeavors for myself has not been much. It's been a rough month for my home. We've just had illness roll through my home and my wife is working really hardcore, and so I have to, you know, be solo parenting a lot of the days. And the worst part was my wife can't get sick, so it ended up being I had to be sick with the kids and isolating ourselves and taking care of that. Well, oh man, it was so. I mean, I guess there's some creativity in parenting when that happens.
I was just gonna say, even if you're sick, I'd imagine parenting is maybe the most creative thing you could possibly have to do.
But I'm exhausted. That's really the
yeah.
So when you're exhausted, creativity just doesn't come as well as you would like. But who knows? If you are looking for a sci-fi and fantasy writing community on Discord, head to mythosinc.com and join ours. And if you have any questions, suggestions, or comments, email us at podcast@mythosinc.com or tweet us at @mythosandinc. Until next time, fellow wayfarers, go build worlds. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.